Well, a man in Flagstaff has made a tree his new temporary home. He actually tied himself to that tree, hoping to prevent the construction of a 14-mile pipeline that would take treated water from Flagstaff up to Snowbowl. There he is. His name is James Kennedy. He's a student at NAU. He's been sitting in that tree. It's in the path of the project. And the ropes holding him up are attached to other trees, as well as the machinery crews use to build the line.
There's one going to that tree and then attached to the machine right there, and then there's one going to that tree and attached to this tree right there. So pretty much if you cut those ropes, the platform will fall and it'll risk its life.
Wow. Well, Snowbowl wants to use the treated water to make snow there at the resort, and this protester and his group believes it is unsafe to use.
After serving 9.5 years in prison, environmental activist Jeffrey Lures is finally free. In June of 2001, Jeff Lures, then a 23-year-old environmental activist, was sentenced to 22 years and 8 months in prison. His crime? Setting fire to 3 light trucks at a Chevrolet dealership in Eugene, Oregon. He said he committed the act to raise awareness about global warming. The fire was put out with a regular fire extinguisher. No one was hurt. The damage to the cars totaled something like $30,000, $40,000. The cars were repaired and eventually sold. Jeff and his co-defendant, Craig Critter Marshall, were arrested minutes after the fire was reported. By the time of Jeff's trial, a year later, he was facing 13 charges and 100 years in prison. In 2001, former Lane County Circuit Judge Lyle Valour sentenced Jeff to 22 years and 8 months in prison with no possibility of parole. Craig Marshall took a plea deal and served 4.5 years behind bars. Jeff Lures' case became known around the country and around the world. Amnesty International and the Eugene Human Rights Commission questioned whether his sentence was politically motivated. In 2007, the Oregon Court of Appeals overturned Jeff's sentence and reduced it to 10 years. Last week, on December 16th, Jeff Lures walked out of prison a free man.
Before we get started, Jeff, if you want to maybe talk a little bit about your story, because I think some people maybe are not quite familiar with it because it did happen a while ago, and of course the mainstream media is not going to cover it. So you were actually arrested in 2001 and you were sentenced to 23 years and 8 months for burning, what was it, 3 SUVs it was?
I was actually arrested in June of 2000, and I was convicted and sentenced in June 2001. I was convicted of setting 3 cars on fire, or 3 light trucks on fire at a car dealership, and of the attempted arson of an oil tanker truck at a refinery plant.
Right. Now, no one was injured or hurt in that arson, right?
No, there were no injuries in any of the things I was convicted of.
And what I think this is important also. What was like the amount of damages for these trucks that were burned?
The damages ended up being less than $40,000.
Right. So even after this, no life was injured, no person injured, $40,000 in damages. They still charged you, they sentenced you actually to 23 years and 8 months, which is pretty incredible. And this actually came up in Feral Futures where I met James. We talked a little bit about this case and how we think that you were one of the first people who were actually used as an example for this green scare stuff that has come up after that. And also, yeah, James is here and I'm glad that he's here too. He's an organizer with Protect the Peaks. And James, I'm not sure if you would want to consider yourself, do you consider yourself to be an activist, or how do you describe yourself right now in connection with your work?
I definitely don't mind the label, but I usually go by, you know, concerned community member or someone that has to act as someone that lives in Flagstaff based on the circumstances. But either way, I don't really mind. But the way we try to frame it is we're normal people. We're not professional activists or anything. You
know? Okay. And I know activist is sort of like a dirty word these days sometimes, so I just want to be sure I'm not like slandering you or something. So, so yeah, I think the first question I want to ask you guys is, kind of related to the consequences of maybe continuing business as usual right now, because like I said before, a lot of people, they're really still stuck on this symbolic protest model. And as you know, with the election coming up, you can read it on the internet and you can hear it in conversations. A lot of people are still, unfortunately, caught up in this idea that the political system is somehow going to change things or save us from disaster. So my question for you is, you know, if this state of affairs is allowed to continue, you know, and if we continue on this, you know, current trajectory, where do you both see things heading in the near future? Or maybe in the distant future, it depends. Maybe we can start with you, James.
Do you mean that like nationwide or locally for our individual struggles? Or?
Maybe both.
Well, I guess I speak in terms of locally. We have a few separate movements. The first is we're working to protect the peaks. The San Francisco peaks in Flagstaff are a Dene, Hopi, and I think more than 10 other tribes' holy site. So we work in solidarity to help protect the mountain from further development, and most recently, Snowball, the ski place that's developing the mountain, wants to put treated sewage effluent, which they call in the media reclaimed wastewater. So we're working to stop them from putting that on the mountain. And essentially, I know at least for Dene people, once that touched the mountain, because that water has touched, you know, it's been to the coroner's office, it's been to the morgue, since it's touched death, spiritually, from what I understand, once that's on the mountain, that's almost a point of no return. And that's coming up just 2 months from now in November, I think. So that's our point of no return. But regarding the peaks, we still don't continue taking action that isn't more than symbolic without guidance from elders, from indigenous elders in the area, and indigenous people in general, because we're allies in that struggle. We're not leading that struggle. And for us, it's never been symbolic, I think, because, you know, we're at 0 hour. Once this wastewater hits the mountain, it's a point of no return. You know, it's almost game over. So symbolic protest, I think, was an initial tactic years ago. And now, I mean, it hasn't been anything for the past two or three decades. So it almost, for me, was never on the radar. You know, we needed to take direct action to stop, number one, the pipeline that's going to Snowball, that's going up to the mountain to carry the reclaimed water. And then number two, to stop their development and clear cutting. But then we're also working locally to protect our water resources, because they want to use and they are using reclaimed wastewater in parks, you know, any public places in the city where they can use this water and it has antibacterial resistant bacteria in it. And so we're working locally on that effort, and that's, I'm not sure if I would call it an indigenous-led effort, but it's an effort in the city that doesn't have as direct of a correlation to the sacred site. So for us, we have a little more leeway in terms of, yes, we do use symbolic protest to garner media attention and to gain support, because I think some people, and especially corporate media, they like to frame the symbolic, the peaceful protest, you know, the ineffectual protest as the only way to protest, the only way to get your voice heard, the only way to take action. So I would say it's not completely irrelevant. It's one tool in the toolbox when we take action and we get a lot of media attention and we're trying to spread the word. But when it comes down to functionally stopping a pipeline or stopping clear cutting or preventing our children from being exposed to dangerous bacteria, you know, I think we'll use any means necessary. You know, if somebody's going to hurt your kids, if somebody's going to hurt your neighbors and your friends, you know, do you stand outside with a sign or do you physically remove them from your house or away from the people you want to protect?
Right, right. Now, so, Jeff, if I want to ask you the same question, but maybe if you could maybe frame it. I'm not sure if there's some issue that you're focusing on in your area right now that you want to talk about, but if maybe you want to also talk about on the bigger picture, what's going to happen, you know, if we just allow business as usual to continue right now?
Well, I think that we're actually living through the time where America becomes an overtly fascist country. I think that protest is cultural. You know, when you look to other societies around the world, you look to the Palestinians, you look to the Greeks, you look to the Irish, people resist in methods that are ancestral and cultural to the places in which they come from. And here in America, we have been totally conditioned into, we petition our government for redress by standing around holding signs. It's the time honored system by which you protest in this country. And people hold to that because it's traditional. They understand it. It's a comfort zone. But what has changed is its effectiveness. I mean, we see that we have these protest zones now where the only place you can go and hold your sign is this designated block that's miles from where an event is happening and surrounded by cops. That's, right. I mean, that's no longer effective even in a sign holding capacity. And I think that we see these forms of repression when people use effective means of protest or effective means of changing the debate, in which the government tries very hard to discourage that from ever happening again. The Occupy movement is a really great example of how that's happened recently. We saw largely what was a very nonviolent nationwide, international wide movement, in which now when you look at, you know, Oakland Occupy movements, you look at some of the Portland Occupy movements and some others in the Northwest, we have multiple felonies stemming from incidences of where nonviolent direct action that took over ports or took over universities was suddenly deemed a threat, and now it's being classified as terrorism. There's several raids that have happened recently here in the Northwest in which friends of activists and self-identified anarchists have been targeted for these grand juries that apparently, as much as anyone can figure out, pertain to anarchist organizing, especially within the Occupy movement. So we're starting to see a crackdown on anarchists, very similar to what we saw with the Green Scare and environmental activists going to prison as terrorists. So you see that there's this increased repression against people that are willing to push the edge of protest a little bit further or push for making it effective, and this demonization of it within the government and within the media, so that it's slowly basically eroding not only the desire to protest, but the civil rights necessary to protest in this country. I think that we have not only reached a point in which we live in a police state and need to resist that inherently, but when we start to factor in things like global climate change and pollution and upcoming famine, class issues that are rampant in this country, and horrible foreign policy abuse issues, all those are categorical grounds for resistance under international law.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. And the scary thing for me is that, you know, the spectacle society that we live in, it's really upping the ante. So like, so many people are just not even aware of a lot of the things that you just mentioned, or they're aware of it, but they think that it's not that important. That's really a troubling thing. And on the other side of that coin, we have activists who, they see all the problems, they see what we're going through, and also revolutionaries, they see what's going on. And yet they feel that the only way that we can solve the crisis is by, you know, turning to a sort of authoritarian, almost military style approach to eco defense or to whatever type of defense that they're trying to do, whether it's like anti-racist actions or whatever. I think this conversation has come up a lot in reference to deep green resistance, like the official stance that they've taken on like how they're going to do their activism or their, you know, their resistance activities. It has been very authoritarian because they say the crisis is so extreme. The only way we're going to win is if we adopt some of the tactics of, you know, the people that we're fighting. I wanted to ask both of you, you know, how can we mount a serious challenge to our enemies without, you know, sacrificing our values? Because it's, like you said, we are in a very serious point in time where we have to do something. But how do we avoid, you know, going down that dark path of saying, you know, we need field generals or whatever? else nonsense has come up?
I think the first thing that we have just utterly failed at, and in part that's because we've utterly failed at learning radical history as, well, predominantly a middle-class white movement from the radical environmental and anarchist sense of things. And I think we fail to look at our history in that we need a united front. Like, it doesn't matter whether you're using militant action or whether you're using above ground action. What matters is that you do it with cohesion, that you stop bad-mouthing each other, especially to the media and especially talking to the cops. Mm-hmm. I think that, you know, we are very polar in our struggle of one or the other. You hear people proclaiming that we need nonviolence and nonviolence only, and then applying these very dogmatic rules to protest. On the other hand, you can see the more militant people doing exactly the same thing, saying we're out of time, we need to do it like this, 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 not like you. But if you look at the Black Panther Party, for example, they've very effectively mingled their above ground and underground tactics. If you look to the Shaq movement, the animal rights movement, Stop Huntington Animal Cruelty, they are actually probably by far the most effective campaign strategy to follow in terms of above ground strategy and underground cohesion. So effective, in fact, that four people who ran a website and all they did was post things that people had sent them got convicted of terrorism charges because Shaq was able to effectively remove Huntington Animal Laboratories from the New York Stock Exchange and get all these other companies to start participating in them. So to me, we got to shy away from people that are speaking in absolutes, because there is no absolutes in a revolutionary struggle. You need to be flexible. You need to be smooth and be able to flow with what's happening.
Right. James, you said earlier that you're at a very critical moment with the struggle that you're going through in Snowbowl in Arizona. How are you able to make decisions? I mean, I imagine that there are people there who have different ideas about what strategies you should use or, you know, what tactics you should use. I mean, how do you come to a consensus about how things should work?
I mean, there are times that we don't. And I think, like what Jeff said, you know, that's a very great idea in terms of being absolutist and, you know, fetishizing processes where, you know, we're not flexible. And I think one of the things we've managed to avoid here in Flagstaff is, you know, sort of hyper-individualism or going to the other end and being just super focused on, you know, we have to have consensus on this. So in terms of decision-making here, you know, we definitely have one, you know, we have working groups that do above-ground issues and other groups that work on other projects. You know, I don't have a lot of experience outside of Flagstaff working in radical circles. So I don't know what we're doing wrong or what we're doing right in the context of other struggles in other areas. But we also take a lot of our lead, you know, from elders and indigenous folks that have been fighting this struggle for generations. So, you know, a lot of that also isn't in our hands, thankfully. You know, a lot of that responsibility is on the people that say, you know, yes, this is a good idea, or no, this isn't a good idea, because that's not a collective process. That's a process done through the people that have lived here for generations and struggled for generations.
Right. Now, you recently did a tree sit there to block the pipeline, and I was wondering, you know, how did you come to the decision to do that? Was this a group decision, or was this something that you just decided to do when you brought it to the group? I mean, who was involved in this, or was it just more of an individual thing?
It's definitely a mixture of both. Without getting into too much detail, I think a lot of like what our models are based off of is like you have, you know, maybe a tacit understanding between above ground and underground, and definitely communication on what's going to be effective media-wise, and what's going to be effective tactically and strategically. So taking all those into consideration and having, you know, contact with, say, whomever is going to be the public face of something or whomever, you know, isn't going to be breaking the law, is working with you, but maybe not directly.
Right, right. And Jeff, you have done, I guess, a good number of tree sits also, I guess back in the day when you were doing, I'm not sure, I would like to hear also like what you're able to do now. I don't know if you're restricted from certain types of activism, but are you still able to engage in direct actions or, I want to hear about that, but also I want to hear about your thoughts on the types of direct actions that are maybe more effective than others. Your thoughts on that?
Well, I am currently still on supervised release until December 15th. That said, inherently all of us can act and do anything anytime we want. That is the beauty of the revolution. The only constraints are what we put on ourselves.
There's
a little plug there. But I think I tend to be more involved in speaking events and maybe speaking with and hanging out with organizers and giving some feedback and some ideas. I don't really directly participate in things anymore. As far as what I think is effective protest, I think, you know, like James said, it really comes down to strategy and what's going to be most effective in the moment. I think the questions that people need to be asking themselves when they're deciding what they're going to do is, first off, what am I comfortable with? Second, am I willing to push my comfort level? And am I willing to accept the consequences of my comfort level? And then you can start looking at the types of things that you want to do and what's going to be most effective. Sometimes you need to look at the problem and be like, wow, the biggest issue here is that more people don't know about this. And so you need to do something that really gains public attention, whether it's a media spectacle or something else. Other times you need to look at it and be like, wow, people really know about this and they've tried to stop it and they can't. So maybe I need to use an extra legal tactic here to accomplish what can no longer be accomplished any other way. And I think that's how you need to look at if your action's going to be effective or not, is you got to look at it, say, what change do we need to accomplish? How best can we accomplish that change?
Right. James, do you have anything to add to that, or?
I definitely think, from my experiences in, you know, radical circles, is you, without, you know, checks on certain privileges or just having, you know, group input, you do get a lot of, well, you need to do this, where you're not a real anarchist, you know, or you're not radical enough. And I think, like Jeff said, you know, really basic, well, things that you would think are common sense, you know, need to be checked when you look at a situation like that. You know, like, what am I willing to do? And if you're not willing to do something, that doesn't make you any worse off or better of a person. And I think sometimes we get pushed to certain levels or allow ourselves to be pushed. And I think that's where you get burnout, you know, and that's where you get people leaving radicalism and you know, turning to the other side or just leaving the community in general. So I think part of that is keeping your community healthy, you know, and being realistic with what you're doing and what you're willing to risk.
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, we here in Philly, we ran into this issue a lot during Occupy. And I think a lot of us went into it thinking that, oh, this is just going to be like a de facto radical thing because everyone is like angry and we all see the problems. But it turned out to have so many like reformist people there and people who just were not, I don't know how to put it. They just didn't really have a good grasp of what the issues were. They didn't know anything about privilege. They didn't know anything about colonialism or anything. And it was really difficult to try to plan actions when you don't really have a sort of common ground, that people are coming from. So how can we take, you know, a group of people, like say you're living in a big town or a city or something, and you have a bunch of different people that are coming from so many different places in their life, maybe socioeconomically or racially or ethnically, you know, sexual orientation, whatever the case may be. How do you, in your opinion, draw all these people together to actually be effective in doing something? It seems almost impossible, but it has been done in the past. But what are some strategies that you guys think are good for that? Maybe Jeff, start with you.
I think we so often forget the community and the community's needs. We live in some really screwed up times, and it's very easy to be angry and want to go after the things that are causing the problem. And so often in doing so, we forget to try to help the people that are suffering. Mm-hmm. And I think the best way to build support and to build a diverse resistance culture is to start doing community service things and bring back feeding hungry school children, get out there so that other people can see you and see that you have something to contribute to their life. I think more than anything, the only way that we can move forward is by making it so that people aren't scared of anarchists and they're not scared of change and they're not scared of something new. We resist, but we don't provide a framework for what happens if we win. And we really need to start realizing that if we want people to switch, if we want people to have an alternative lifestyle, then we need to start providing that alternative lifestyle.
Oh, definitely. James, anything to add to that?
I don't want to piggyback too much on what Jeff said, but I think that's absolutely right. You have, people that are new to the movement, and I think especially folks like myself and others, when we come into this romanticized idea of activism and anarchy and other forms of radicalism, it's romantic. It's not doing hard work like writing a press release, or flyering or getting resources together and driving or biking and collecting things to help the people around you. And I think recognizing that it takes hard work sometimes, most of the time, to build alternatives. I think one example where those kind of meshed was that down in Phoenix, the local white supremacist group would march on the Capitol every year. And anarchists and other radicals would confront them every year. And the more recent strategy from the Class 4 Council in Phoenix was to bring libertarians into that, say, well, you're against fascism, just like our forefathers and other family members were in World War II. So they built this coalition that confronted them in the hundreds in downtown Phoenix. And as folks are walking back, everyone that lived in the area, mostly Hispanic families, are coming out of the houses, and they're cheering folks on. They're stoked that you're there. They say, did you kick those white supremacists out of our neighborhood? And I think that sort of solidarity work, think with common sense, what does your community need? What does your community want? And in terms of having a diverse group of folks coming together that don't know each other, like Occupy, I've been involved in a couple actions with Occupy. And I think the biggest, most simple effective form of communication to solve those disputes was being direct. We had one guy who was ordering people around and asking them to confront the police, and someone just walked up to him and said, hey, you've been telling people what to do for a while. Maybe you should take some initiative. And, that didn't 100% solve the problem, but it made a big impact and it started a dialogue. So I think when we don't know folks, sometimes we're not as direct as we could be.
Right, right.
In a rational way without being aggressive.
I think to add to what James said is it's so cliche, at least in, anarchist circles, but at the end of the day, it really comes down to we all just need to kill the cop inside our head.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah, definitely. I think you guys made a lot of good points. Here in Philly, one thing that recently came up that I think is really good is this jail support collective where people go, they set up a table at a bus stop where it's like right near a prison where people, I guess their family members or the people who are being let out, they can come and get some food or water or cigarette or just someone to talk to when they're leaving, because a lot of people, I guess, come out distraught, of course. I thought when I first heard about this, like, wow, this is brilliant. Like, why didn't I think of this before? Like, how come we never had anything like this before? This is something so basic that the community needs. And we've been like trying to organize people against the police and against the prison system. But it's really, like you said, Jeff and James, these really simple things of like giving back to the community and meeting people's needs. You know, this is how we can build, you know, a more radical alternative to what's going on right now, which is really not that great. So my next thing I want to bring up is, sort of related to something you said, James, about like the native issue. Like how, you know, what does it mean to be an ally? You know, like this came up a lot at Feral Futures in Colorado. We had like a really long and, sort of, you know, protracted, interesting discussion about this issue. You know, what does it mean to be an ally? How can you be an ally? I mean, is it even possible? And when I think of my ideal ally, I always think of, Rachel Corey. And are you guys both familiar with her?
Yes.
Yeah. I guess.
I don't think I
am. Rachel Corey is, she's a Anglo-Saxon, I think, young woman from, I think she's from Washington State. She was from Washington State. She got involved in Palestinian, solidarity struggle. And she went over to Palestine a few times, and on her last trip there, she was doing some work in the Gaza Strip to help stop the home demolitions that were going on during the Second Intifada. And she put her body between a Palestinian home and a bulldozer, and the bulldozer ran her over and crushed her to death, and she died, basically. And I think why I really view her as a great example is because she came from a privileged background. You know, she didn't have to go there and do that, but she felt so strongly about the issue that she was taking on that she was willing to sacrifice her life for that. And I think this is something, that is very, it's not something that we should like put up on a pedestal because, oh, well, she's a, you know, a white woman from privileged background who did it, but it's saying that it's very difficult for people of privilege to do those type of things because the society that we're living in gives people such an easy ride. Like, why would they want to do something like that? So I think that when people do things like that, we should, you know, give them some kudos for that. And I was just wondering, you guys, if do you have any, examples of an ally, you know, that kind of inspires you or did inspire you or something like that?
Yeah, actually, tagging on to your story, cause it's very, very related. When I was inside, I had, pen pal in Haifa, Israel, that was part of the Palestinian struggle. And we wrote back and forth regularly for all the years that I was locked up. And that person sent me a letter with one of their letters that had been smuggled out of a Palestinian internment camp. And the prisoner who wrote me, I still have the letter actually, wrote to express such a level of solidarity. And what they said was that I had given them courage because they felt, because I lived in America where it must be so hard to resist, that I was able to find the courage to fight back, that it inspired them over there to fight back. This person had one of their family members smuggle this out of one of their visits. And had they gotten caught, they never would have seen each other again. And it was that important for them just to express that message of solidarity. And it opened my eyes so much to just how connected our struggles are. They're global in origins because we're inspired by the resistant movements in other countries. And we're just connected. I mean, at the end of the day, we're really all resisting the same thing. And to be able to impact each other and find inspiration from each other, like it's incredible.
Yeah, that's a really great example. I remember when I spoke to you a few years ago with my friend Jenny for the Authority Smashing Hour, you mentioned that also, and it's an amazing story, you know, That's like really amazing. James, do you have any kind of an example of an ally? Because I know you're there right close to the Navajo Reservation or the Diné Reservation. You're kind of different from a lot of people in the activist or radical circles where like you're actually embedded in an area with a lot of Native people. So do you have any ally figures that kind of give you inspiration?
I think the person that comes to mind is one of my best friends in Flagstaff, Ned, who has lived here for a few years, shorter than I have, but they've been friends with our friend Klee, who's Diné, for a long time, for more than a couple of years. And I think the experiences that Ned took out of their friendship with Klee, I think having a real connection there, right? You know, so what happens to your best friend is happening to your community. So it's very real, and it's not very separate. And Ned has done youth organizing for over a decade in LA and in Flagstaff. They identify as transgender, queer, and Ned's also Mexican, so they have a lot of intersecting identities there. But Ned took this experience and their own experiences in organizing and working with people of privilege to be able to unpack, I think, a lot of questions that me and other folks have when we're trying to reach more of a anti-colonial mindset versus us going to Klee or other Diné folks all the time. We now have another ally, you know, that's one of our best friends that can explain things to us. And I think what I've learned from that is just, you know, number one, learn, you know, like learning the Diné language is an experience in itself. You know, learning just about another culture is one of the first steps, I think. And then checking your own privilege, which I think is very difficult for folks that have that in whatever way. And also, I just want to plug what my friend Travis Jeans in Phoenix likes to say. When people speak of allies, he says, not allies, accomplices.
That's a good
really
one.
Great phrase. And it really changes how I think. You know, am I somebody's ally or am I their accomplice? Hmm. And I just, that unpacks a lot in my mind for me. But it's really hard for me because it's a daily process. We just had a meeting at the info shop at Tullahoan in Flagstaff regarding, you know, decolonizing and the amount of collective members that are from white backgrounds and how we take up space and how we interact in the info shop. So it's, you know, it's not we're an ally and that's it. You know, it's something you work on every single day and you're going to mess up, you know, and you're going to do something inappropriate. It's not obviously not something we try to do, but it happens and we get over it and we work, you know, in the best way possible, you know, with the best intentions. And that doesn't always make it okay. But the fact is that we're attempting to move forward when we can. And I wanted to comment real quick on what you and Jeff were talking about in terms of moments of connection and sharing struggles. And I think it's amazing because I've heard Jeff's story, obviously never talked to him before, and just even having this conversation, this interview now, is inspiring, you know, and it brings momentum and a lot of freshness to the movement. And even just the sharing of ideas, I think, is real important. And I think we can't get enough of that in the radical scene, you know, between Occupy, between anarchists, between whomever. And I think it's really important, the work that D-Green Philly is doing. So.
Hey, thanks, man. I really enjoy doing this. You know, like the most amazing people I've met through being involved in radical work, and I've been so inspired by Jeff for a while, and also meeting you at Feral Futures this year, and other people. Did I tell you? Oh, I haven't told you this, obviously, but one of the Diné people from Flagstaff was here in Philly recently, and it was like really amazing to have her here. And we went to like this museum. And we were like, we're going to check out some native, some native artwork in the museum. And they didn't have any. They didn't have any. And it was just like a constant learning experience. Like when you're looking at things through a radical lens and through like a lens that maybe people don't normally see it. And when you have other people who can kind of, you can commiserate with and they can say, yeah, I see the same thing that you're seeing. And it's like really amazing. Do you guys think we have time for one more kind of broad question? But it's not that long, but, how are we doing with time?
I have time.
You do? Okay, great.
Yeah, I'm poor.
Okay, good. This next question is, it is kind of connected to this this idea of being in solidarity with the Native struggle. But first I have to mention how I came to think of this, and this is from this article that was, it's on, let's see, the Anarchist Library. And the title of this article is The False Promise of Green Technology. And I guess both of you are sort of familiar with anti-civ ideas, you know, even just generally, right, I guess?
Yeah.
Yes, yeah, so this article is basically talking about how all of the different solutions that were being given, you know, by the mainstream green movement are basically going to, you know, take us in the wrong direction and basically lead to a dead end. The stuff like, you know, photovoltaic light bulbs or, you know, photovoltaic, what do you call these things? Solar panels and wind farms, like all, it goes into all of the different problems with all that type of stuff. But here near the end of the article, they're talking about, the fact that, you know, human beings, humanity, we've been living without industrial society, without industrial technology, you know, for the majority of human existence. And they mentioned a few native tribes and how they interacted with the environment. And I thought this was very interesting because my own personal interest in the native struggle is because I think that we have to learn these native ways of being as a point of, you know, self-preservation, I think, looking into the future. And I just want to read a quick paragraph from this and get your guys' thoughts on something. It says here, instead of utilizing agriculture with its often devastating modifications to the natural environment, these and many other indigenous peoples place an emphasis on cultivating and maintaining the natural abundance of the riparian zones, riverbeds, forests, and valleys. Wild foods were abundant, not nearly as prone to blight or famine as cultivated varieties, and provided superior nutrition when compared to virtually all industrial or organic slash agricultural diets. In total, all of the materials used for the production of needed items, including clothing, tools, and shelter, were ostensibly benign and biodegradable from an environmental standpoint. Preventive healthcare and the absence of industrial pollutants and practices meant that, as a general rule, these people did not suffer from the modern epidemics of cancer, heart disease, or diabetes, for example. So with that in mind, I want to ask you guys about something. It's not really so much as a question, just as like an observation. When we look at the type of society that we're living in, and then when we look at traditional indigenous cultures, you know, without sort of romanticizing them, there's this idea that's been floating around that the type of self-awareness that we have, and also the type of traditions and the customs that we have, these will have a very direct impact on how we relate to the environment. So we can see how, you know, the very profit achievement oriented society that we're living in is producing a very, very negative impact on the environment because we're just concerned with, you know, accumulating products and whatever it is. And just the environment is like a backdrop against which we're just like living our lives or something. Do you guys have any thoughts on this? I mean, I know it's a very broad, like kind of vague sort of thing, but I'm pretty sure these are ideas or thoughts that you're both kind of familiar with.
I can talk widely broad, but you might have to cut me off after a while.
That's fine. I can edit it later. Don't worry.
God, where to start on that? Okay, I'm going to speak from a solely white Westerner perspective because it's my viewpoint of the world, I suppose. I think that in our culture, we have created this weird idea of wilderness. If you look at our society as a whole, even our politics, we have this like sacred fascination with wilderness. We screw it up all the time, don't get me wrong, but we set aside these small little protected pockets where we can't take any technology, we can't build any roads. It's the wild. And because we've done that, because we've put these tiny little pockets away, now we can stop thinking about the rest of the world because we're not part of nature. We're separate from nature. We put nature way, way over there. And we've totally lost this idea that we have an impact on everything around us. I mean, it's absolutely evident. You look at climate change, you look at pollution, you look at the cancer rate in Cancer Alley in New Orleans, the pollution we put into water, the dams we put on the river that kill off salmon. Everything we do has an impact. And yet somehow the whole reason we can't see that we're impacting nature is we fail to recognize that we're a part of it. And I think the only way we go to having balance and stop living in sickness is to recognize that the human built environment is the natural environment. There's nothing separate about it. Everything we do comes from natural materials. Everything we need to sustain ourselves is natural materials. We've just somehow lost that along the way. And what we've replaced it with is a plague. If we go unchecked, if we continue along the path that we're currently walking, we're going to see a massive human die-off. I mean, it's inevitable. If you just crunch the numbers, you look at the statistics, we have this idea of an entire capitalist world. Most of the developing nations are not socialist or communist, with the exception of China. They're capitalist. So we have this idea of all these industrialized nations operating on a capitalist philosophy of infinite growth, except they have finite resources. So it's this mathematical equation that cannot work. And we're starting to see massive soil depletion in this country alone. It's predicted that within the next 20 or 30 years, America's not going to have enough topsoil to feed itself. Hmm. It's not a big news story. No one's really talking about it because, well, it's really the scariest thing out there. But you start seeing these patterns unfolding. And what happens in any ecosystem when any animal outbreeds its resources? They die.
Right. But, you know, the really weird thing is that if you call attention to that, then people try to accuse you of wanting it to happen. Like when you talk about the idea of this die-off, it's like I've heard people do this. They say, why do you want people to die? Why do you want this to happen? We're saying we're trying to stop that from happening. We don't want that to happen. But that's what's going to happen, you know, if we're continuing on this path that we're on right now.
I hear you. I have this argument in so many events where I bring it up, and it's the same thing. People say, you know, if we do this, millions of people are going to die, and they fail to see the big picture, which is millions of people are dying right now. Mm-hmm. I mean, climate change isn't something that's happening in the future. Climate change is something that's already killing people in Africa. I mean, hell, it's killing people in France with the heat wave they had there last year.
Yeah. James, I think this is really connected to the stuff with the snowball also, like this idea of people seeing themselves as separate, so separate from nature that they think that they can just go and spray, you know, bacterial laced snow on the mountain, like everything will be fine, like nothing will happen because of that. Do you have any thoughts on this in connection to snowball or in connection with your own personal take on this whole issue?
I think it's definitely a settler mindset, right? That there's a wilderness we're going to conquer and then we're going to separate ourselves from. Just like snowball spraying the wastewater on the mountain, you know, they think, oh, we'll just reuse all this wastewater because we were going to waste it, but now we're reusing it and it's probably fine. Kind of like solar and wind, you know? People thought that was the salvation until you find how many precious minerals it takes to build solar panels or the amount of birds killed by wind farms. So it's all emerging technology, you know, and it's all new stuff that we don't know very much about. Like the study on the bacteria that were resistant to antibiotics in the wastewater literally came out 2 or 3 weeks ago. So it's brand new research. And there's research done on this wastewater poisoning trees as well. And this is all coming out within the last month. So,
I mean, has that been done before, though? I never heard of that happening, like them using this sort of wastewater and using it as snow before.
I think it's in use in a few, like, you know, places like Texas, Phoenix, for for one, you know, all their tap water is reclaimed water. It's different state by state, though, and I think Arizona has one of the lower standards for treating water.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Unfortunately, yeah. Sorry to cut you off. I just wanted to know about that.
No.
Yeah, so did I cut you off from saying something else, or were you...
I would just like to connect it to, you know, part of, it's like a pseudo-privilege of being able to be disconnected from the environment and the catastrophic systems. And it's now it's catching up to people in the first world, you know, people that are middle class and above. Because here on the Dene Reservation, you know, all the nuclear, the uranium mining and nuclear weapons testing has poisoned the earth, and it's poisoned thousands of Dene people with cancer and radiation sickness and other things. So that's something we've exported to other people in other countries for so long, and I think now that it's catching up to, you know, it's going to threaten whole cities, whole countries with global warming, now they're going to take minor steps and start greenwashing. But as far as, you know, anti-civ thoughts, you know, a lot of that, to be honest, is pretty new to me, especially, you know, my experiences with you and other folks really brought up a lot of stuff that I, you know, hadn't read into before. We're so busy, I think, looking at a lot of the short-term stuff that's going to happen to us and our friends, that long-term, it's just like, oh, wow.
Yeah.
Like 2 years out from this, we're going to run out of water, too, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's why it's important for us to come together and talk about these things so we can, you know, see both the short term and the long term and the different perspectives that we all bring to the table. Because like other people have said, no one person has the answer. But if we come together and work together, we can definitely figure this thing out. I'm still optimistic, even though there's a lot of reasons to be pessimistic. Just talking to you guys makes me more optimistic, and seeing things that are happening here and in other places, people do want to, they want to do something. Like, they know something has to change. They know something has to happen. It's just a matter of getting people organized and getting people the information that they need to make the, you know, the right decisions and stuff like that. So guys, it's coming up on an hour, and this has been like a really fascinating discussion. I just want to know, do either of you have anything that you want to, mention or plug or say before we end it here?
Yeah, I think that, you know, the most important thing for people to realize is that it all starts with them. You know, power is nothing without control, and all control really is someone else making you behave a certain way when they're not even around. Mm-hmm. Control is knowing that when you tell someone to sit in the corner, they're going to stay there even when you leave for 12 hours. And when we can find the courage to no longer be afraid of their control, of their power, when we can say, there's nothing you can do to me that I'm afraid of, I accept it all, that's when you truly break free, and that's when you can really start fighting back.
Amen to that. James, anything?
I'd like to thank you, Ron and Jeff, for both talking to me. I think it's a great experience for me. And I think in terms of an anti-colonial perspective, I'd like to add that folks should think critically about how colonization has played into what's currently going on, and how decolonizing our mindsets can help us face a lot of the struggles that we're entering into and that we have been a part of, you know, such as the destruction of the earth, you know. So what did our cultures do in the lands they originally inhabited? And of course, you know, if indigenous folks are willing to share their practices and experiences, I would definitely, you know, learn from them. Dene people have been farming up here in the high desert for thousands of years. And when climate change makes our environments even more extreme, those are definitely tools and techniques that hopefully folks will share so we'll survive.
Thank you.